Man.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And welcome back, everybody. We're tanned, rested, and ready for another live Midrats. Going to kick the summer off. Hopefully, everybody has recovered from whatever you were doing over Memorial Day weekend and getting the kids out of school and enjoying perhaps a little less traffic, at least where I live. And we're going to kick off the summer here with what we do three times a year. No guests today, no agenda, no problem. We're going to have a free-for-all, just Eagle One, myself. And if any of y'all are interested, you can always jump into the bottom of the show page where the chat room is. If you have a little bit of stage fright, you just want to type in your thoughts. If you have some questions for us you'd like for us to address, this is an open opportunity. In the pre-show, Eagle One and I were talking about what we want to talk about. But as always, we're more interested in what our guests and other people have to think. So if there's something that is really buzzing around in your bonnet, please let us know. Or even better yet, because we do occasionally take callers when we have our guests, but that's the exception, not the rule. When we do our little free-for-alls, we also like to open up the phones for anybody who is listening live and would like to call in with a question. And you can reach the switchboard at 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. We'd love for you to come in, give us a call, tell us what you think. And if you got some ideas for shows you'd like down the summer too, this is also a great time to do it because that gives us some time to get in touch with people and see if we can get them lined up. Enough of my prattling on, though. Eagle One, welcome back, and you ready for summer?
Oh yeah, it's going to be a busy summer for me, but I think I'm man enough to handle it. So.
You'll take it. Well, I've done the last harvest on my peach trees, so that's about the best beginning of a summer I can get. I always got to be careful because you and I will start talking in the pre-show and we'll start throwing out all our ideas like, hey, the show hadn't started yet. And why don't we go ahead and get started the conversation today, and maybe it'll prompt some of our listeners to come in on the chat room or get a phone call as well. But while we've been off in the best of land and the world has continued to spin, I thought one of the more interesting things that's come up, kind of folded into one of my little maxims, is you can come up with all the plans you want to, and as you ponder it, don't be surprised if other people use it against yourself. And we had our last couple of shows where we discussed China. One of the topics we came up with as course of actions that we can take to perhaps to help shape events in our direction, maybe enhance our alliances, et cetera, and so forth, is to play a little bit of lawfare on them. You can smile and be nice and use the diplomatic side of the equation, maybe the economic side of the equation, the informational side. And in the last few months, it looks like China has thrown a spanner in the works. The last figure I saw was they're building their little sand castles, which I guess were one Admiral Halsey Memorial Super Typhoon away from getting rid of, but they've created 2,000 acres plus or minus of some sand down in the Spratlys that they're going to try to strap an airfield on. And I think most of our listeners have seen the Mighty Orion's replacement, the P-8 Poseidon, and the crew being told in a sand pebblish way, you go away, which was very interesting to see. What is China doing? And from an international law perspective, what happens when one nation says, hey, this shallow reef is now sovereign land. Have we been here before? And what game do you think the Chinese are playing with us?
Well, this is an old game for the for that area. I mean, the Philippines and Vietnam have also had and have islands that, you know, I mean, it's, yeah, that are out there. That when, in fact, the Philippines has a bunch of their Marines. I think they are living on a wrecked and rusty LST that the Chinese keep preventing being resupplied by anything except by air. So that the Philippines government has to airdrop supplies to these guys out in the middle of no place. And Vietnam's got some place like this too. But I mean, what is different here is that those settlements were on existing land masses or high points slightly above the water. Here, China's taken things that may not have even been above low mean water, but and have developed these islands. And, you know, they claim under their 9 or 10 dash line theory that a big bulk of the South China Sea is there in water anyway. And you end up with a situation, and Jim Kraska from the Naval War College has written on this stuff extensively. I highly recommend people follow his Twitter account, and I've been retweeting his tweets. But you know, it creates a really interesting situation. They're going to claim that they're, I mean, in one course, they could say that this particular spot of land we developed is now is ours. It's sovereign, which means that we're going to claim all the EEZ and the 12 mile limit around these islands. Subject to the international rules of, you know, you got adjacent land masses, all that stuff. So, you know, that's one theory. And the Chinese are saying that this is historically our water, so we're just going to do this. And, you know, the trouble with international law, I keep trying I'm not an international lawyer in the sense that I go out and worry about treaties and things like that most of the time. International law I was working with mostly had to do with maritime and admiralty law. But the focus on this is that their position is that if it's their sovereign territory, you know, they can put armament on there. They can in theory, they could weaponize. And I had a blog post on this. They can weaponize the islands and dare anybody to throw them off. And that leads to the question of how do you enforce international law? Let's say that that some court says no, you're not entitled to this. Who is that court, and how many armies do they have? And navies in this case, or Marine Corps. I mean, how do you get a force that doesn't want to move off land they claim is theirs, even if in international jurisprudence they're found not to have that right? And I guess you can do all kinds of good trade embargoes and stuff like that, but, you know, given the amount of trade we have with China, that would be a kind of a big step for us.
And thought was interesting in some of the critiques that have come out about China. I forget the author, but someone made the observation that a lot of the pundits look at China as a fantasy land where they assume that they just want to talk about all the positive things. They don't give really a nuanced position. But one of the things the Chinese do is it seems that they're cross purposes where they one action of theirs will be counterproductive on the other. And depending upon how this develops, you know, one thing they've been trying to do, I know over AFP reported earlier in May that China is trying to get a base in Djibouti along with the French. I think even the Japanese have a small supply base there, and of course the Americans do. China has invested billions of dollars in infrastructure in that area, including Ethiopia, access to airports, et cetera, and so forth. At a pretty delicate negotiation, I don't think the Chinese are really helping themselves by being that belligerent close to home that they're, you know, how much the French and the Americans are willing to go along, I think could be negatively impacted if Chinese continues to make efforts as a bad player or at least a disruptive player in the international arena. I don't know, did you get a chance to read much about a couple of the articles? I think the phrase is kind of cheesy, but that's okay. It describes it well in a fashion. But they're talking about the Chinese new Silk Road routes both through Central Asia, but also the sea route, which is this traditional sea lines of communication coming from Europe to the Far East. Whether they're really playing the long game in that respect, and could this belligerency close to home affect their negotiation to get access to ports over there?
Yeah, I have been reading those, and it's, you know, they've not only developed this or developing the stuff in Djibouti, but you know they're tracking these ports in Pakistan. They've got some pipeline deal going, I think from Burma to China, to avoid the Strait of Malacca. They've got all kinds of stuff going on, including an investment by somebody to build a new canal through Nicaragua, you know, which will be Chinese funded completely. And, you know, whatever situation they're going to have going with some of the other South American countries or Central American countries or even the Caribbean countries, you know, it is a challenge in some ways directly to some of the U.S. interests. If we choose to look at it that way, in some ways it is, and Claude will have to help me here, but it's, it's Mahanian. I mean, they're doing exactly what, Mahan called for in his works. And the other day I saw a story that said that the People's Liberation Army, or whoever's in charge of this stuff, says, you know, we're going to change our focus from land matters to we really need to focus on the sea. That's our new key interest. So as the U.S. asserts a Pacific focus, the Chinese are beginning to assert a seaward focus. We were talking about those sea islands earlier. You know, I see those as kind of like a land power thing. I don't think they really want to have fixed bases. I think Admiral Blair, retired Admiral Blair, who was SyncPac, that's not right anymore, is it? Who was Commander Pacific, said that, right, you know, a fixed land base does you no good in the event of a war, because how long does it take us to take out an island that's, you know, 15 acres big? Wouldn't take that long. But, you know, if they start focusing on their projection of power using their ships, that's a whole different ball of wax.
And you also have the peacetime economic issue. If they push this as their sovereign territory, then they have their economic zone around it. And I think somebody mentioned in the chat room that a lot of what Vietnam and the Philippines have done of reinforcing islands that are already within their EEZ, where does that peacetime economic pressure come in? And I don't know how much we can play in the international law arena to counter that, because when it comes to, sounds a little judgmental, but that's okay. It's one of my tricks. If you think FIFA is corrupt, you ought to see the way the Chinese conduct international relations. Can we really practice lawfare and play by what we consider our civilized rule with the Chinese, when you look at what they've done in Panama and Central America and with the infrastructure developments in Africa? They can do things economically and influence people in ways that we really can't inside of our legal structures.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I don't think they have a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that restrains some of their corporations, and I use the word loosely because most of their stuff is either seems to be owned by the PLA or in some sense or another. And you know I think one of the Craig in the chat room just points out that in South China Sea they're mostly using their Coast Guard, which is largely true. They keep shouldering. You know, they don't like us looking at their aircraft carrier operations. They want to shoulder our observer aircraft away from their submarine operations, and they're using their naval forces and aviation components to do that. So it's not just it's just the Coast Guard stuff. I think the issue of the exclusive economic zones, you know, that is one of the things they're challenging. Their argument is that if you take the way the exclusive economic zones are defined under the United Nations Treaty and the Law of the Sea, then their EEZ is much larger and could push up much closer to Vietnam and to the Philippines, and the Philippines and Vietnam are willing to agree to, particularly since there seems to be some rather serious oil exploration going on in some of the areas that the Philippines are trying to develop, and I think Vietnam's got the same thing going on. You know, and it seems like several years ago, after the end of the Vietnam War, that somebody took down an oil platform near Vietnam, and we had a lot of people go missing after that event.
Yeah, I think something else that is probably interesting to watch, it's one thing that I've been waiting for, is all powers, when they expand in the maritime arena and mercantile nations that rely on sea lines of communications, one of the I guess initiating actions that they take that kind of announces their presence is when there is a threat near one of their choke points that impedes their trade, or an act takes place that is a direct threat on their sovereignty, they do a punitive expedition, do a few feet, a few boots on the ground, break some things, kill some people, put some friendly people in place, and get back to business. And when you look at the Chinese interest in the Horn of Africa, they're trying to get basing rights in Djibouti, it kind of ties in with the growing anarchy in Yemen. And I've been looking for, you know, where are some spots that's outside of its traditional conflict and opponents, which could spiral out of control quickly, where the Chinese could make a statement if somebody does something to interfere with their trade. And again, a very poor country that produces more history than can be consumed locally, it almost looks like the what we called the Barbary Mandrell Straits, and an off of Yemen. That might be one of the areas where that we may see the Chinese kind of make their, we're an international mercantile republic that will use our military if need be. And I don't know really if there's anybody that would oppose them if they wanted to make a statement there. Are there other areas you think that we might see the Chinese use their military to reinforce their global economic statement?
Yeah. You know, you've got, I think if you look at their economy and see, you know, how badly they need natural resources, they're gonna do, I think, what it takes to protect those resources. Now, that may mean that they cut as many deals as they can with Iran to make sure that, you know, their flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz is unimpeded. It may mean that since there are also Saudi oil ports in the Red Sea, it may mean that they're going to have, you know, they will look very serious about what they want to do with Yemen, or they may be smart enough to see that we don't know what's going on in the Middle East. I'm sure that I don't think they're a whole lot better off than we are as far as trying to figure out who's what and doing what to whom and when. They just may wait. And, you know, as long as they are able to keep their supplies going without interfering, they may have no incentive to go in there and do anything to clean up any of those messes, but just wait to see who comes out waving whatever flag and then cut a deal with them. I mean, money talks, and they seem to have enough of it to do a lot of speaking.
So your thoughts in a place like Yemen that the Chinese might go to, what they really do seem more comfortable with is using their financial ability and the ability to pay people off, in this case probably the Iranians, to keep the Shia, at least not to do anything stupid in that regard. I watched really closely when the Chinese did non-combatant evacuation operations off of Libya. If somebody did something stupid there, I mean, they're at the really far edges of their ability to operate militarily. I think that's the type of circumstance that we might see China do something to make that kind of statement. But I think you're right. If they'll smart, and if they don't feel the need to do what previous nations have done as they had reached the level they have led, then, yeah, they'll just probably buy off proxies and not have to worry about it. I think, you know, yet to be seen. There's a reason why nobody messes with Russians. I think perhaps people don't mess with the Chinese simply because it's more profitable not to.
Well, they're not viewed as an imperial power. I mean, historically they have been. It's been a long time since they were imperial power, and as the U.S. Has kind of in the eyes of some of the world, as we've de-imperialized and tried to withdraw ourselves from being the world's policeman and protector of all things that are right and true. The Chinese have not stepped in. They've been perfectly happy up until fairly recently that the U.S. spent its dollars and human beings to keep the sea lines of communication open for the rest of the world. And, the Chinese started pretty modestly in the anti-piracy effort in the Indian Ocean with the Somali pirates. But, you know, they are playing on a world stage, and they're just getting used to it. But the development you see, the large merchant marine they have, the development you see around the world where they're buying their way into ports, they're buying, you know, they have a company that runs the ports, just like they bought into the Panama Canal operation. The money they're going to spend in Nicaragua, it's a pretty impressive and expensive process. Now the question is, and you've raised this before, are they going to get old before they complete all this? And I'm looking at a young officer. If I'm a young, we just had a graduation from the Naval Academy, graduation from the other academies. If I'm a young officer, I'm looking 15 years down the road. What is the world going to look like with all the changes that are happening right now?
Yeah, that's spot on. And the one thing we do know is the incredible aging that we will see in China. And we've discussed on a few shows here, I know with Toshi Yoshihara and with Jim Holmes especially, that internal economic concern should drive most of China's actions. And I think it really does tell what they're doing with their land trade routes through the former Soviet republics and, of course, their sea line of communications route, that to tap into what Bismarck was thinking a century and a quarter ago, describing what he saw potential conflict, some damn fool event in the Balkans. Unless there's some damn fool event involving some useless hunk of rocks inside the first or the second island chain, there really is no reason why, regardless of what direction China goes, that they should naturally come into conflict with the U.S. Because at least the U.S. direction, in a bipartisan manner, is if not retreat, then just benign status quo, as long as China doesn't feel the need to make a point or some damn fool thing happens on a useless rock somewhere. I think we may just be able to do this peaceful competition in a mercantile way, that if something does take place, it might take place between China and a third party, or even the U.S. and a third party. But I really don't see any reason why we should necessarily come into conflict.
Yeah, but that gets us back to the South China Sea, which is, you know, if there's going to be a place where they would seek a conflict if they choose to do so, they've already sought, you know, they come up and run into one of our planes and then lose one of their planes, blame it on our P3 guys, they land the EP3, they strip it of all the intel stuff they could get, They shouldered aside the MSC ships we had in there doing some research, end quote. They're pretty aggressive against the Philippines. I'm not sure that the Chinese have a single focus. I mean, this is the problem I think you were talking about earlier, that they have a military side that seems to be, you know, kind of ready to be a bully boy. You know, we're ready to do all this stuff. And then they have the other side, which is playing this much longer mercantile game, which probably isn't in conflict with the U.S. since we're, you know, one of their better customers. But I'm not too sure how those two pieces are talking to each other.
Hey, shifting from a quasi-rational player with the Chinese, let's talk about somebody else we're trying to get our head around is a quasi-irrational player. And by the way, I think We've been doing the show over 5 years, and I'm more than happy to toot our own little horn here. And by the way, we got to get Dr. Gorenberg on again, our go-to Russia guy, to talk about again. But when nobody wanted to talk about Russia, we had some guests on here that wanted to talk about Russia. I recommend people go to the archive and listen. But it's interesting note. One of in my younger days, one thing I read up as much as I could on was the Winter War between Finland and the then Soviet Union. One of the great lines in ground combat: "Look at all the Russians." And the other guy says to himself, "Where are we going to bury them all?" But the Finns put out a notice. Not a big nation, but they know their history well. So they have over 1 million former conscripts that are in the reserve. Sent a little tap on the shoulder to remind them where they are to do to show up. We've seen Germany do a second guess and tap up on their defense spending. Same with Poland. You've seen Ukraine recently using one of the few little PSYOPs weapons it has, is going to fully open the Soviet archives they have possession of in Kiev, and is building their partnership with Poland, trying to build as much as they can with their Baltic neighbors. And we've seen Lithuania especially, but Latvia and, of course, Estonia, small nations of just a little more than 1 million each, starting to nudge towards that 2% of GDP of defense spending. I don't really know at this stage of the game whether the thought that people had, if we just do more sanctions against Russia, it's going to make a difference. Putin's playing a longer game. What are your thoughts is driving him? Is just trying to recapture a little bit of the former imperial glory, or does he have some deeper mission in mind besides his own political expansion?
Well, great question. I don't know. I wrote down in preparation for the show, I wrote down some thoughts, and one of them was a topic that was called the New Europe and the Old Russia. So, you know, some of it seems to be just a reaction to so many, you know, they view the world, they appear to view the world as a dangerous place, and that having an enemy right on their borders like Ukraine and all the other countries that are near NATO status or in NATO, right there on their borders, that seems to make them unbelievably nervous. On the other hand, Putin has now reached out to the Chinese. I saw this morning that the Russians are going to hold some kind of joint naval operation with the Chinese in the South China Sea. So, I just can't tell if he's doing this to tweak the U.S., just as a lot of the comments that President Obama makes seem to be designed to tweak Putin. And how much of it is the natural Russian instinct to build a strong barrier between themselves and the rest of Europe and Europe, because Russia does not always strike me as being a European power, but certainly as a big chunk of Asia, to protect them from God knows what, because I don't think Napoleon's going to rise up out of the grave and come tromping into Moscow again anytime soon. So it's an interesting question, and I can't read Putin well enough to know, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't see the an economic, a demographic, a philosophical, or a political reason for Russia to be worried about their borders, comma. However, that's thinking about it in a Western context. And like we've talked about before, I think that's an error, that you you look at a Russian and you go, he's Western. No, he's not. He's he's Russian. I don't know if you quite call him Asiatic, but it's not really a nation and a culture that seeped in the Enlightenment. And when you look at their history, and if you wanted to draw a line in the sand, just go ahead and do it from the American Revolution, what they dealt with Napoleon, what they dealt with Hitler, their own nightmarishly apocalyptic civil war, the cultural wire brushing that they got during the ruling of the communists. They've got a lot of internal psychological issues and insecurities. Now, I think I mentioned to you before when I was in St. Petersburg talking to our bus driver, lady, maybe 60 years old. This would have been about 7 years ago. She just was just all nostalgic about the Soviet time, and it had everything to do with psychological issues about we were powerful, we were feared, we made things. I remember her taking her hand and waving it towards the industrial area, the port at the mouth of the river that goes into St. Petersburg. It's like, now we just export raw material. We're just extraction economy. Waved her hand. So yeah, and maybe that's one thing that Putin can do is he's created an environment recently where he has to keep this going because I think if he shows any weakness, then that desire to be respected and feared again, if anything goes backwards in that regard, I think politically he's toast. But speaking of politics, what is the long-term game with Putin in his party? Is this another cult of personality? Does he actually have a political philosophy there? That's one thing I can't understand because he's not immortal. What follows Putin? I have no idea.
It's power and a corrupt, a thoroughly corrupt society. But, I started rereading Huntington's The Clash of Civilization and Bernard Lewis's The Crisis of Islam and, John Mearsheimer's stuff, because it's all the things that are going on are predicted in those works, the Russian Slavic mindset, what Huntington, I think, refers to as he distinguished between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church and that whole situation that goes on there. Plus, their country is not made up of it's so diverse in many ways that, the only way, and just like with Yugoslavia, the only way to keep it together was to have a guy, ruthless dictator in charge, maybe. So maybe that's what Putin sees. If I want to hold this together and keep my money people happy, I've got to act this way.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is Russia tries to figure out what it wants to do. I guess one of the cautions a lot of people need to keep in mind is America is always one election away or one event away from completely turning on a dime. I don't know if it's a bug or a feature that we don't have a national strategy, and even when we do, we don't follow it. We could be kind of mercurial there, but a lot of people might be familiar with Ian Bremmer, kind of the foreign policy guy. And he has a book out, and I'm not pimping the book. I just found his three courses of action interesting to contemplate. When he talks about, what are America's options for the rest of the century? And he mentions three that I'll just go ahead and read here. There's let's see if anybody's interested in reading it. And if you're in the chat room, I'll go ahead and put the link to the article up there. It's over in the Telegraph UK. But he mentions three items here that I think is interesting. He says, America, there are three possible courses in our foreign policy for this century. First option is keeping the faith with the old indispensable America that underwrites global security. Second one is, for you sports fans out there, adopting a moneyball approach where the U.S. pursues its narrow economic and security interests, or three, an independent America where the U.S. gives up trying to solve the world's problems, but seeks instead to lead by example by investing in America's security and prosperity at home. When I look at those three options, the option one is the indispensable America approach. I think neither political party, except for a minority in the Republican Party, have any interest in being the world's global stability person. I just don't think there's a political will right now to do that. The Moneyball approach, where the U.S. pursues its narrow economic and security interests, there's enough realists out there that might want to pursue that, but I don't know whether we have enough people who have the hard edge ability to do it. I think the third option is we're not by intention, but maybe by default, where we're starting to drift, where we are inwardly focused, and we'll look at our security interests at home, but the old lead from behind, and if it's really important to somebody else, then they can go do it. Maybe that's where we're going to be for a while, unless there's something else that comes out that prompts us to want to do something else.
Yeah, I think we tend to lose our focus in this country because, you know, we are not, you know, you talk about a lack of national strategy. We have a national strategy, and we don't follow it because we're too diverse in our own thinking, and we really don't want to force our will on people in the sense of, you know, putting a heavy thumbprint on them. I mean, some people will undoubtedly disagree with that, but you know, we're content to, as much as possible, let people do their own thing as long as it doesn't interfere with us or with the flow of commerce. And we had a nice long run when we were the power in the world after World War II, when everybody else had pretty much blown themselves up or been blown up by someone else. And, you know, the new reality is that we're never going to get back to that position where we make the vast majority of all these products and all that stuff. That world is gone. We are a globalized world. Everything that happens in Muncie, Indiana has an impact, you know, somewhere in Mumbai, India, and in, you know, some remote village in China or some industrial park in China. So it's, you know, that we're not going to go back to that world. The way we look inward, though, is we start looking at things that, you know, what is poor in our society? Where do we best put our dollars? And, you know, the question is whether we have enough people who believe that there are still threats in the world out there that we really need to be focused on. And, you know, so you get these articles on how big a threat is ISIS to the U.S. really? How big a threat is China to the U.S. really? You know, they really can't. You know how it goes. So that seems to be the American mindset from where I sit.
And I don't know if that's really that far of a deviation from traditional American foreign policy, besides the post-World War II era, which I'm glad you brought up again, that reminder, because it is so true. You know, two to three generations of Americans experience was really a unique period of time when all the other world powers, victorious or not, were broken down to parade rest, totally destroyed by the war. I read recently an account of before our entry into the Second World War, that one of the last great gold reserves of Great Britain was in South Africa, and we sent a cruiser down to South Africa to go get it before we would give any weapons to the British. That we definitely played, of those three courses of action, we definitely were playing number two before World War II. And I think the third option of almost a benign indifference is probably where, though I think there are politicians and people in the foreign policy establishment that perhaps have a different idea of what America should do and what our responsibilities should be. But I think ultimately the American public has no appetite for that at all. And perhaps we will return to a circumstance that is more in line with our self-interest. And as we've also discussed here on more than one occasion, if you really want to put on the green eye shade and you look at the economics of what's going to go on by mid-century here, there's just no ability to afford that outside of some global conflagration, which we would come out the other end completely being a completely different nation because of it, just like we did after World War II.
Yeah, and you kind of see that in our approach to the Arctic, where we've got oil and gas interests. You know, the president has now authorized development of some of those resources up there, and what is, you know, we've got Russia, we've got Denmark, I guess, and Canada, the other big stakeholders up there, you know, and China wants to play up there, and you know, who is our defense force in the Arctic? It's going to be the Coast Guard, but I haven't seen an additional dime being, you know, there's a lot of talk, but I haven't seen any additional money being thrown at those guys to have, go here, build another, you know, six icebreakers, and how about some ice-hardened cutters and stuff like that. I mean, you know, you got to judge by where people are really willing to throw money. So it's curious how we do these things.
That's one reason that I've been more irritable than usual about when the Navy decided to play politics with the whole global warming, Arctic melting. You've actually seen people say, well, you know, we don't need icebreakers because it's going to be ice-free. It's absolute insanity that our nation, when you consider, especially up in the North Slope, that we haven't at least shown as much enthusiasm as the Canadians have to hedging a little bit on what really aren't great expenses in icebreakers, modern icebreakers, not to mention the additional resource and the multi-use that they have. You've seen a little bit of warbling by the Coast Guard on that. I think it's unfortunate that they have not pushed that really hard, because I think not just from a pure strategic point of view of making sure we have a modern icebreaking and Arctic capable force up there, that from a research, from an ecological, from an environmental point of view, that you really want to be able to have that and I wouldn't even call it excess capacity, I would say minimal acceptable capacity up there. Because are we really going to rely or want to hope that Denmark, a nation of 5.5 million that has, in conjunction with Greenland, huge amounts of territory up there. And the Canadians, again, they have a population 1/10 of ours, that even though we only have Alaska, it should be of a lot more importance than it is. And, of course, the Norwegians themselves, but thanks to the Gulf Stream, most of the Norwegian interests are relatively ice-free during the year. But the Arctic issue, the Chinese interest in that is almost comical, because of all the places that they might have some historical connection to, it's not the Arctic. Unless they're trying to find some way to exploit the potential natural resources up there, but there's no terra incognita up north, and the only Chinese access is between Russia and the U.S. I'm not sure what game they're trying to do there, except they're just trying to see, let's go up there and see what happens, see what the reaction is, see if we can get our foot in edgewise. Maybe we can buy out somebody's interest to get our foot in the territory. I've been also surprised that the many ecological interests haven't spoken out more against that, because when you talk about a delicate environment up in the Arctic, the last nation I would want dropping any type of drill rig in that part of the world besides the Russians would be the Chinese, because their record of taking care of the environment is just a horrible rolling train wreck.
Well, the only way that I can see they have any game they can play up there is there's a dispute between Canada and Russia and the U.S. and the Norwegians about exactly where the continental shelf is off Russia and Canada and Greenland and all that, you know. So I guess there, if I'm the Chinese, I'm looking at this, there's a potential dispute up here. Maybe there's some way I could just, and Claude hit on it, we can go up and build an island in the middle of the Arctic and then dare everybody to throw us out of there, you know. And I think that would be resisted by pretty much everybody, but, you know, maybe that's the clever scheme they have.
Yeah, that would be kind of funny. Why did the Chinese drop anchor here? What is this big pipe for? Oh, you've got to be kidding me. Yeah, that would be cheeky if nothing else. But hopefully we won't have the Chinese decide that they want to do
it
that.
It would be exciting just to see the hand wringing, people run around in circles dealing with that.
Let's kind of shift our focus here a bit. I had let me see if I can pull this up, because I would rather quote a smart person smarter than me than make it up as I go. But exchanging a little bit of correspondence with one of my people in my circle of acquaintances and friends, who I won't mention, was talking about, speaking of rolling train wrecks, what's going on in Iraq and Syria with the Islamic State. And we all read a lot recently about all those towns that were so important a decade ago to us, Ramadi, Fallujah, Haditha, et cetera, and so forth, still fighting over it. And with the Islamic State taking some significant headline towns like Ramadi, that you had the president saying these are tactical setbacks, it's not strategic, hard to get a handle about. I think we really have three different battles going on with the Islamic State. And when you look at what happened in Ramadi, it really wasn't a pitched battle street by street. It was more of a thumping of the chest, show of force, the Iraqis retreat, and they sweep up what little resistance left, and they take over the town. From what I have heard and what this individual has exchanged with me, and I think he's spot on, that the Islamic State in Iraq is a lot weaker than they look. They have significant supply issues. Their lines of communication are inefficient and stretched out. What we're not reading about much up north, and I think this will be in a few years a pretty big story, the Kurds are slowly taking back territory from the Islamic State. And I'm convinced they're not going to venture very far from their mountains, because the Kurds even have a phrase that the only friends the Kurds have are their mountains, so they're not going to take big chunks of land. But they are going to nibble things back. I think it was in the 80s, and for lesser extent, sometime during the 90s, Saddam had a policy of ethnic cleansing, kicking Kurds out of certain villages and replacing them with Sunnis. So I'd expect the Kurds to return the favor and take back some of those villages they lost a generation ago. But though they are weaker than what they look like in Iraq, they are significantly stronger in Syria than they had been. And I think most people have read about the Assad Syrian forces, the Shia forces, retreating on some significant areas, including Palmyra, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. That is all the discussions about the loss of Ramadi is really masking their consolidation of their power in Syria. I don't think this story is going anywhere anytime soon. And I think we may see, whichever direction this goes in, that an additional area for conflict and concern is going to be the Kurds' consolidation. And I don't see any conceivable scenario as this goes on and Iraq becomes more and more broken into sectors that the Kurds will ever be part of any Iraq that may or may not exist in the future. And Kurdistan proper in what used to be northern Iraq is going to become as much of a state as the Islamic State or the caliphate, whatever they want to call it, are going to be over the next 2 years. Because I don't see any force out there that really is going to displace them, especially in their Syrian holdings.
Yeah, it reminds me of the old joke about the two guys are running away from a bear that's chasing them, and one guy runs past the other guy, and he says, you don't ever outrun the bear. I said, don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun you. I mean, ISIS doesn't have to be strong or even very good or have great supply lines, but whatever they've got is better than whoever they're opposed to, apparently. So you know, right now they're just a little faster than the other people in there. And, you know, how much of this is on the basis of sectarian lines? How much of it is on the basis of tribal lines? How much is on the basis that the ISIS is just, you know, more aggressive and that the, you know, the traditional Iraqi army doesn't, you know, if it's not unwilling to fight, doesn't seem to be really devoted to saving Ramadi for some reason. But, you know, I don't have a good feel for this at all. The ISIS continues to attract people from all over the world, and they're playing a winning hand right now. I don't know how long they can sustain it, but they just have to sustain it longer than everybody else until people say, well, we're just going to acknowledge they exist and move along, I guess.
I think the Islamic State is going to grow. I think they're going to expand their franchise operation. Because remember, the primary franchise operator was Al-Qaeda for a long period of time. And they were seen as, from the Islamic extremist point of view, they were the strong horse to play. Now the Islamic State is actually holding territory, making alliances, and there really is nobody that is effectively fighting them. I know that a lot of people strongly disagree with me, but I'm a firm believer that a huge strategic mistake we made was not swallowing our pride and flip-flopping a bit and finding some way to, if not doing it directly, make a deal with the Russians to let them support Assad in Syria, if nothing else, to make them strong enough to bleed the Islamic State white from the West as they were trying to hold Raqqa, which in the apocalyptic canon that they subscribe to is extremely important town for them to hold. But as that situation did not take place, I don't think Russia's going to do it on themselves, I think you're going to see the Islamic State franchise continue to grow, and it's going to grow in places that we're not going to expect it to. I think it was smart, and hopefully will continue to be smart, that we'll keep a larger force in Afghanistan than we would otherwise. We've got to get through this year's fighting season. We'll see what happens next year. But you could very well see the Islamic State franchises there grow. Hopefully, and it sounds silly to say this, but hopefully the Iranian-supported Shia in Yemen can do something to at least make it more difficult for an Islamic State affiliate to grow there. I know Al-Qaeda goes over to the east, but it's all just a big furry mess that hopefully we got big brains working on it. And here's one thing that a few months ago, this used to be firmly in the quackdom, the crazy conspiracy strap on your tinfoil hat routine, that I've actually heard some respectable people mention in stage whispers. Let me roll this to you. One of the reasons it's such a complete mess is we're really not doing much to oppose it. And neither is anybody else, mostly because they don't have the capacity to, and they're waiting for us to lead because that's what people are used to doing. That President Obama and his administration do not want to do any more than it's absolutely the minimum. They're given three options. Whatever is the least option that doesn't involve us running away completely, they'll select. That they're just trying to do a holding action until they're out of office, because he doesn't want to, in the last year and a half of his office, to be distracted from what he really feels like he was elected to do and what he really feels like that he wants to do and became president to do, which has everything to do with domestic issues. And so we're not going to see any significant effort on our part until we get another administration come in. How much do you think that is playing into it, in the fact that there's just no desire or mandate on our civilian leaders to do anything about it?
Well, I think it's a huge factor. And, you know, I think that the history of interventions of this administration Now, let's take Libya, where, you know, we led from behind. But, you know, is Libya a success story? Is I mean, you know, his red lines in the in Syria. You know, I think he's just he. You know, if the reality is on the ground that that for some reason we decide it's in our national interest that Syria and that part of Iraq that is affected by ISIS, that it was really important to us that they not be under the sway of ISIS, you know, what's the answer? The answer is we put 100,000 troops back in there and clean up the mess again. But, you know, you and I grew up in the Colin Powell era, and I'm having trouble figuring out our national interest in the middle of this, in the middle of the Middle East. I mean, you know, at some point, the sins of post-World War I and the divisions of the land between the French and the Brits and the in that part of the world, you know, that is going to have to be dealt with, and it seems that we're dealing with it now, again. I mean, but maybe this is the final way that plays out. That whatever these divisions are going to be, they're going to have to shake out in the next 5 years, and whether or not the U.S. is going to play in that in any way other than keeping our allies in the area as safe as we can, you know. We'll have to deal with that, but you know, if the Iraqis want to come to us and invite, you know, a couple 100,000 troops in there, I think the U.S. Congress would go not only no, but hell no. So I'm not sure that this isn't one we just sit on the sidelines and kind of watch it play out.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's absolutely zero political will, and the American people have no desire to go abroad seeking dragons to slay. And though it may be hard to figure out what the present administration's strategy is, and maybe President Obama is running out the clock, but there's a very good chance that maybe that is our best option. Our best option is to decide not to decide. Do what we can on the edge to keep it mildly weak, which I think we're doing.
Minimize, keep it contained. It's a containment policy.
Minimize risk to us and our forces, because I think we both know that if any American was taking prisoner, the huge benefit that would be to the Islamic State, you just can't measure. So you minimize that. The American public has absolutely no desire to save people who they don't think want to be saved and probably don't. So we may just by accident or intention wander into what will probably be, like it or not, the best course of action to take.
Yeah, which, you know, I mean, all the people who normally scream for humanitarian interventions and things, I don't hear them yelling, you know, we got to go save these Christians, we got to go save the, you know, these other groups that are being decimated by the Islamic State and their, you know, more rigid interpretation of their religion than some folks have. So, you know, I haven't heard any of those voices. Everybody's kind of just tired of it. I mean, I'm not sure what commitments we've made to the Iraqi government. I don't think that Secretary of Defense Carter really impressed him the other day when he basically called him, you know, painted a yellow stripe down their back, but
pretty
so
accurate.
It goes.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, it's interesting you mentioned, as we come in last minute, the what people used to call the CNN effect. I think that the American people have perhaps sobered up a bit, that people remember the Somali famine and what did we get for our help then. They looked at the Afghan women being shot in the back of the head in a burqa, not being able to be educated, et cetera, and so forth. What did we get for our trouble there? The Iraqi Shia and the Kurds and the Iraqi people and the nightmare living under Saddam, and we gave an opportunity to get, and what did we get for that? Maybe we just do need to shrug for a while, and I don't think that any of those nations if they do have a huge humanitarian emergency, that we're going to want to do anything. People are just going to shrug their shoulders and went, well, we've tried that before, and it never gives us anything from grief. So there we go. And you know what? We just ran out of our full hour, and so we were just talking to people who recorded or listened on the recording. So I might as well go ahead and tell everybody, next week we'll be live again, and our guest will be returning guest. We're glad to have her back. Mackenzie Eaglin, she is the resident fellow at the Maryland Ware Center for Security Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, where she works on defense strategy, defense budget, and military readiness, which she's been doing for a long time. And we're going to have her on to discuss about what looks to be a foreign policy focused general election, more so than we thought perhaps a year ago. So I'm looking forward to having Mackenzie on again next week, Eagle One. And before we sign off, do you have any thoughts or observations?
No, just to say that I hope over the course of the rest of this year and until the next time we do one of these shows, we have all the experts we need to answer the questions we raised today.
Yes. It was funny. I think I did this to myself, and occasionally in the course of answering, we'll disagree with ourselves and, you know, debate ourselves in public. It's a beautiful thing.
There you go. There you go.
But for everybody that is still with us on the recording, the Kedzie Hour, we really appreciate everybody joining us here as we are approaching 5.5 years of doing the show. And always want to extend an invitation to everybody. If there's a topic you'd like for us to cover or a guest that you would like for us to invite on, please let Eagle One or myself know. We always like to bring on good and exciting guests like we're having next week with Mackenzie Eaglin, and we appreciate all our regular listenership and the constructive observation and points of improvement that we always get on the show. And until next week, we'll see you for another edition of MidRats. Cheers, everybody, and have a great Navy Day.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame for love that fairly draws.